Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Anatomy Murders, being the true and spectacular history of Edinburgh's notorious Burke and Hare, and of the man of science who abetted them in the commission of their most heinous crimes, by Lisa Rosner, narrated by Kirsten Potter. Introduction. The Burke and Hare Murders. Though neither was native to the city, and both are long gone, William Burke and William Hare remain two of Edinburgh's most famous residents. Over a 12-month period, they killed 16 people, 3 men, 12 women, and 1 child, in a murder spree which ended only with their arrest in November 1828. The motive was profit, for Edinburgh was a major center of medical education, and lecturers would pay high prices for subjects, that is, cadavers for dissection. The means was a form of suffocation. Assisted by Hare's wife, Margaret, and Burke's companion, Helen McDougall, the two men enticed their victims to drink to insensibility, then lay on top of them, compressing the chest while holding the mouth and nostrils closed. Burking, it came to be called. The crimes were made possible, in part, by general conditions of the early 19th century city, with its large mobile population and small police force. There were additional contributing circumstances. Margaret Hare ran a lodging house for transient in the busy immigrant district known as the Westport, and Dr. Robert Knox, the up-and-coming anatomist to whom the killers sold the cadavers, asked no questions. "Murder is no novel crime," wrote one contemporary journalist. "It has been done in the olden time as well as now. But murder perpetuated in such a manner, upon such a system, with such an object or intent, and accompanied by such accessory circumstances, was never, we believe, heard of before." Its deep tragical interest made it picturesquely horrifying, and it has retained its hold on the popular imagination ever since. Burke and Hare are famous among true crime aficionados, forensic experts, and devotees of horror stories. They have been depicted in literature, on stage, and in film. And whenever questions are raised about the lucrative medical transplant industry or the illicit harvesting of body parts, we are sure to hear the story of Burke and Hare. These were the first serial killings to capture media attention, 60 years before Jack the Ripper. The early 19th century was marked by an enormous expansion in the popular press, and news of horrific murders sold sensationally. Edinburgh newspapers eagerly followed the story, providing daily and even twice daily reports and commentary. These reports were reprinted and embellished in the periodical press from London, Manchester, and Dublin to New York, Boston, and the Ohio frontier. Full-length versions followed as soon as publishers could set the type. First off the press was Thomas Ireland's Westport Murders, a series of 24-page pamphlets later combined in a single volume. It promised an authentic and faithful history of the atrocious murders committed by Burke and his associates, containing every authentic particular and a full disclosure of all the extraordinary circumstances connected with them, illustrated by portraits drawn from life and other highly interesting copperplate engravings of plans, views, etc. Ireland had not quite completed his print run when the publisher and bookseller Robert Buchanan issued his more upmarket book, The Trial of William Burke and Helen McDougall. Advertised as the only authentic edition of the trial, it featured sworn testimony from the murderer's neighbors and associates, as well as a corrected version of the proceedings. Buchanan published 2 other sets of documents relating to the murders over the next few months, reprinting local newspaper articles and pamphlets not available elsewhere. An avid reading public scooped them up, binding them together with lurid illustrations, broadsheets, and caricatures. The murders became part of the lore of Edinburgh, a story steeped in the distinctive geography of the city, with its tall, grey tenements dispersed over a very irregular surface of ground, wrote Thomas Shepherd in his 1831 collection of engravings, Modern Athens, and placed partly in valleys and partly on the tops and sloping sides of hills. He compared the High Street, lying on the highest sloping ridge, to the backbone of a herring, with Edinburgh Castle at its head on the west end and Holyrood Palace on its tail to the east. The ribs were formed by the numerous narrow lanes called wynds or closes running steeply down the hillside, and the Hare's House in Tanner Close, southwest of the High Street, became notorious as the scene of most of the murders. Scottish writers have always been drawn to Burke and Hare. Sir Walter Scott followed the affair as avidly as the rest of Edinburgh at the time and discussed it freely with his friends and legal associates. So did John Wilson, the literary force behind Blackwood's Magazine, under his pen name of Christopher North. Known for its macabre tales and an important influence on Edgar Allan Poe, Blackwood's made cadavers and body snatchers staples of periodical fiction throughout the 19th century. Robert Louis Stevenson drew on the murders in his short story masterpiece, The Body Snatcher. The playwright and surgeon James Bridie took up the murders in his 1931 play, The Anatomist. More recently, Burke and Hare had a cameo role in Ian Rankin's Flesh Market Close. Modern visitors to Edinburgh will hear many Burke and Hare stories, some of which are even true. The rest, of cadavers hauled up secret passageways, of beautiful prostitutes dissected by their lovers, are gruesome and enthralling, easy enough to believe on a foggy November evening, passing under a bridge or climbing a dark stone stair. The impact of the murders reverberated well outside of Scotland, for they coincided with political developments that ultimately transformed modern Britain. In 1828, the Tory establishment, which held power in Parliament, was under attack by Whig opposition leaders agitating for governmental reform. During precisely the period that Burke and Hare peddled their cadavers, a Whig-led parliamentary committee was investigating the way in which medical schools obtained bodies for dissection. The Select Committee on Anatomy, as it came to be known, made public the dangers inherent in the body trade. Once the murders came to light, committee members seized on Burke and Hare as the true authors of the reforms they proposed. The government, they claimed, was responsible for the crime which it has fostered by its negligence and even encouraged by a system of forbearance. Radical publishers Cowie and Strange issued Murders of the Close, the first novel based on Burke and Hare, featuring engravings by the political caricaturist Robert Seymour, best known today as Charles Dickens's first illustrator. Within a few years, the Whigs were in power, and the Tories had all but ceased to exist. In 1832, Parliament passed the Reform Act, which legislated an unprecedented increase in the number of male voters and gave representation to Britain's growing industrial centres. In the same year, it passed the Anatomy Act, which legislated procedures by which medical schools could obtain dead bodies. In 1837, Queen Victoria ascended the throne, marking a new era in British history. The Burke and Hare murders became permanently enshrined as a symbol of the bad old days before Parliament's great reform, before enlightened legislation and modern progress. By 1861, when Alexander Leighton published The Court of Cacus, or The Story of Burke and Hare, the bad old days seemed very bad indeed. Leighton had briefly studied medicine in Edinburgh in 1826, but he went on to be a lawyer's clerk and later a writer and editor of Scottish tales. He had connections in Edinburgh medical circles, and his book reflects the marked changes that had taken place in the medical profession. Three cholera epidemics had come and gone, killing thousands, but transforming public health institutions. Educational reforms and licensing regulations had raised the status of physicians to the dignified professionals of the Victorian world. Louis Pasteur in France, Robert Koch in Prussia, and Joseph Lister in Scotland had all begun their path-breaking work on the germ theory, creating modern scientific medicine and permanently fusing the image of the healer with that of the scientist. Layton and his readers expected doctors to be heroes. They looked back on earlier generations of doctors with some sympathy for their efforts, but distaste for their barbarous practices. And they viewed the behavior of the previous generation as shockingly unprofessional, from the invective used against rival practitioners to the methods used in obtaining cadavers for dissection. The Court of Cacus, then, was in part an exposé of the medical practices of the 1820s, a delineation of the shadows that made subsequent advances shine all the brighter. Layton disclosed some of the dirty little secrets of the Pre-Anatomy Act medicine, the existence of professional body snatchers who roamed the graveyards of Edinburgh, the raucous competition among medical practitioners for fame and fortune. The true villains of his book were not Burke and Hare, nor were they the medical profession as a whole. Instead, Layton put the blame on anatomy teachers, who created the demand for bodies, vying to see who could most callously overstep the bounds of human decency in obtaining them. Villain in chief was Robert Knox, who had sworn to outdo his rival lecturers and chose possession of fresh cadavers as the means to do so. He was, according to Layton, a marked man, as befit the main character, in the great tragedy subsequently enacted. He was a brilliant surgeon, Layton argued, but that was the problem. He was so concerned about being preeminent in his field that he was blind to all other considerations. His vanity and ambition, his vindictive impatience of an intruder on his particular walk, as Layton put it, brought about his downfall. There were eyewitnesses still living in 1860, and Layton interviewed some, but he also invented fictional eyewitnesses when it suited him, and whole sections of the Court of Cacus are simply made up. Unfortunately for the cause of historical truth, wrote the physician Henry Lonsdale, Robert Knox's former assistant, Layton had dressed up his story so well and introduced moral and pious reflections to suit the Scottish mind that many mistook his work for a bona fide narrative of events. Writing 10 years after Layton in 1870 and after Knox's death in 1862, Lonsdale's avowed goal was to set the record straight. He did so by presenting Knox as a supremely talented scientist like Lister or Charles Darwin. Admired by his students, venerated by his patients, Knox could have had a brilliant career, had it not been blighted by his unwitting association with evil men. Oddly, though Lonsdale wrote so vehemently against Layton, he repeated many of the same Burke and Hare legends found in the Court of Cacus. His later status as Knox's colleague and defender gave them a spurious air of authenticity, though Lonsdale was only 12 years old, still living at home in Carlisle at the time the murders took place. Layton's and Lonsdale's books became the basis of the most influential work on the murders, William Roughead's Burke and Hare, published as a volume in the Notable Trials series in 1921. Roughead was trained as an Edinburgh lawyer, though he never practiced, preferring to devote himself to writing on true crime. His introductory essay gave an insightful and entertaining overview of the crimes, for Roughead was an excellent storyteller. The rest of the volume provided a reprint of Buchanan's 1829 edition of the trial, as well as the later supplementary publications. Roughead brought to the murders the sensibility of the detective story genre. Though the Burke and Hare story is not a whodunit in the usual sense, the 19th-century versions had left a raft of unanswered questions for readers brought up on Wilkie Collins and Arthur Conan Doyle. What was the psychology of the crime? Were Margaret Hare and Helen MacDougall guilty, as well as the two men? What had Knox and his assistants known, and when did they know it? Was there a cover-up on the part of the judicial authorities? Roughead sifted the evidence, examined contemporary publications, analyzed legal documents. He also added an ironic style and an early 20th-century relish of Victorian indiscretions, so if a salacious anecdote suited him, he did not look too closely at its provenance. In this way, some of the least reliable details from 19th-century publications became firmly embedded in the Burke and Hare saga. Within a few years of Rough Head's Burke and Hare, Sinclair Lewis's Aerosmith provided a compelling portrait of a new type of physician-scientist, a researcher rather than a clinician. During the 1930s, as new vaccines and medications appeared to tame one deadly epidemic after another, films like William Dieterle's The Story of Louis Pasteur and Dr. Ehrlich's Magic Bullet glorified the efforts of medical researchers. In somber counterpoint were movie versions of Burke and Hare, which juxtaposed the evil of the killings with the good to which doctors might turn the murdered cadavers. Robert Wise's 1945 horror classic The Body Snatcher, starring Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi, depicted a surgeon dissecting a woman he knows has been murdered so that a crippled young girl may walk again. Dylan Thomas's 1953 screenplay, The Doctor and the Devils, was the basis for the gritty 1985 film with Timothy Dalton and Jonathan Pryce. It, too, confronted viewers with questions about the costs of medical progress. Even as we draw the line at murder, do we ignore other dubious practices? Black market sale of body parts? Medical experimentation on human subjects without their knowledge? Miracles of modern medicine routinely available to the rich, but not to the poor. These questions are still with us, and they ensure the continued fame of Burke and Hare. But precisely because they are still with us, it is time to take a new look at the facts of the original case. A murder cannot be considered solved if its investigation is based on hearsay. A cautionary tale loses its bite if it is based on rumor and anecdote. As a historian, I am drawn to these 16 murders for what they reveal about medicine, but I stay with them because I am also fascinated by what previous accounts have left out. For the past 180 years, writers have relied on contemporary published sources, but a wealth of unpublished materials in Edinburgh's incomparable libraries has been largely unexplored. I use these letters, account books, police reports, and medical notebooks to recapture the voices of the historical actors in this drama, murderers, victims, doctors, and to retrace the paths which led to their often disastrous decisions. I also use them to uncover additional actors, such as policemen, journalists, and Edinburgh intellectuals, all of whom had roles to play as the drama unfolded. This historical detective work provides a new, vivid perspective on the story, one startling in its immediacy and interest. In addition to the strange partnership of Burke and Hare and the medical profession, and the grisly murders themselves, this book is about the intersections of the disparate worlds of 19th century Edinburgh, between lecturers and students, doctors and patients, between the upper and lower strata of society, which made the murders possible and shaped their aftermath. The chapters travel, cadaver by cadaver, through that fateful 12-month period. We traverse the geography of the city and its variegated social and economic life, from the habits of its lower classes to the recreations of its gentry, from the demands of its doctors to the political aspirations of its legal elite. What emerges is a city, a profession, and a crime on the edge of modernity, suddenly confronting innovation in murder as well as in the arts and sciences. Thus the march of crime has far outstripped the march of intellect, according to one commentator. With all the pretended illumination, the present age must be characterized by some deeper and fouler blots than have attached to any that precede it. Its brighter spots were counterbalanced by its darker shades and more appalling obscurations. We will search out those shadows as we explore the worlds of Burke and Hare. Chapter 1. The Corpus Delicti. Margaret Doherty or Campbell. The Corpus Delicti, literally the corpse that formed the material evidence for the charge of murder, was discovered on Saturday, November 1st, 1828. In life, it had belonged to Maggie, or Marjorie, or Margaret Doherty, also known by her married name, Campbell, who thereby acquired the sad distinction of initiating the murder investigation into Burke and Hare. Because testimony concerning her death figured prominently in the later trial, we know more about her than any of the other victims. Maggie Dougherty, as we will call her, was a small woman, between 40 and 50 years old, originally from Donegal in Ireland, but lately residing in Glasgow. She had few belongings besides her clothes: a petticoat, a red short gown, striped, a long printed gown, short-sleeved and open before, and sewed with white cotton thread before. Anyone seeing an older woman dressed in that fashion would know her for a recent immigrant, and in fact, she was a talkative body who told everyone her business. Her husband's name was Campbell, but hers was Dougherty, and she had come to Edinburgh on October 30th in search of her son, Michael Campbell. He had arrived for the harvest and had been boarding for 2 months with a family in the Pleasance, a former county road now lined with lodging houses. But the landlady, Mary Stewart, told Dougherty that her son had left the previous Monday. They had missed each other by 3 days. Dougherty stayed overnight and in the morning went out to find one of her son's friends, working at a shop at the foot of St. Mary's Wynd. The term Wynd meant a lane leading off a main street, and St. Mary's Wynd was a bustling thoroughfare whose picturesque combination of fashionable shops and boisterous street life attracted artists and visitors. Tourists might follow it until they reached the High Street, heading uphill to the garrison at Edinburgh Castle or downhill to the royal residence at Holyrood Palace. Neither of these was Maggie Dougherty's destination. She had no money and had not breakfasted, nor would she tell where she was going, saying only that she did not know where her son was and she was leaving town. Her road lay west on the main route for the migratory Irish, running parallel but far below the High Street, along the Cowgate to the Grass Market and on through the west port of Edinburgh to the Glasgow Road. There had once been an actual west port, or gate, at the western end of the city, but by 1828 the name referred to the Long Street, also known as Wester Portsborough, that was the main port of entry and egress for western Scotland and Ireland. Grocers, spirit dealers, and small shopkeepers of all descriptions, even a bookseller and circulating library, fronted the street, while closes, narrow enclosed courtyards, led to clusters of tenements just behind. Thomas Shepherd's Modern Athens presents striking views of these tenements, exulting that one of these stacks of houses contained no less than 10 stories, or flats, and it is a fact that many of these flats are inhabited by distinct families, whilst one flight of stairs communicates to the whole. Many of the stories had been further divided, either by landlords or tenants, so that each of the rooms on a floor might be occupied by distinct families, with an extra straw pallet tucked here or there to be rented out at 3 pence a night. Until the 18th century, these tenements had housed the Scots nobility and their retinue. But from the 1770s, Edinburgh had embarked on an ambitious series of civic improvements. North and south bridges, far above Maggie Dougherty's head as she walked along the Cowgate, had been completed in 1788, demolishing one of the most populated sections of the old medieval city while furthering urban expansion beyond the old city walls. Edinburgh's New Town was laid out by city planners and private investors in honey-colored stone along elegant Georgian avenues and crescents. As each new section was completed, the wealthier classes abandoned the narrow, crowded Old Town tenements for larger, more modern residences along York Place and Charlotte Square. The north and south bridges grew congested from the carriages rumbling through the Old Town, and plans were underway for a new route, the modern George IV Bridge. The city had burst its medieval boundaries to the east and south as well, with well-maintained coach roads leading to the fashionable seaside resort of Portobello or to gentlemen's estates in the Pentland Hills. There were many among the upper classes whose business or profession still brought them to the Old Town, lawyers attending the courts in Parliament Close, professors and students in the newly completed quadrangle of Edinburgh University, doctors heading to the Royal Infirmary and Surgeon's Square. In the evenings, though, the old town was left to those who could afford nothing better, separated from the city's expansion not just by bridges, but by indicators of poverty, such as higher infant mortality and lower literacy. A kind of spotlight shone upon this economic disparity every evening. The old town, the immense houses of which, towering one above another, are seen from the splendid line of Princess Street, wrote one foreign visitor, is particularly brilliant at night. This old town glitters every day of the week with numberless ranges and clusters of lights, as other cities do only on great festive occasions. Yet all this splendid array of lights is the consequence of poverty and wretchedness. All these high houses are filled with crowded inhabitants from cellar to roof, and every room has a separate family. All these poor people are at work till very late at night. Light glimmers from the window of every crowded and comfortless room, whilst in the houses of the rich, whole suites of rooms lie unoccupied and consequently dark. Yet we should not think of the old town as the depths of misery and depravity, or Maggie Doherty as a sheep among wolves. Her route underneath the stilts formed by the bridge followed the path of the city's industrial base, including tanneries, breweries, salt works, linen factories, and paper mills. She passed by the fish, meat, and poultry markets, the entrepot of the increasingly commercialized agriculture of the region, where hundreds of animals were driven or carried from the surrounding countryside, slaughtered, and sold. On October 31st especially, the roads would have been as noisy and lively as a country fair, for the next day, November 1st, was All Hallows, the day of Edinburgh's annual livestock market, when the cowgate and grass market filled with sheep, cattle, horses, and their human attendants, and the city overflowed with dealers in agricultural products and their customers. Maggie Doherty had made her way from Glasgow and no doubt felt able to make the trip back again. The migratory Irish in Scotland depended on seasonal work, like the harvest that had attracted Michael Campbell, and, as with other migrant workers, formed their own communities, which retained country traditions of hospitality and mutual assistance. Even a newcomer might find someone from her village or a friend of a friend to give her a bed for the night or something to eat. Indeed, anyone making the trip from Edinburgh to Glasgow on foot depended on such acts of generosity. There are ways in which all long-distance travelers increase the likelihood of encountering generosity, such as recognizing the differing value, in different situations, of using Scots or Irish names. Doherty seems to have called herself Mrs. Campbell, a Scots name, when speaking to the Scotswoman Mrs. Stewart in the lodging house in the Pleasance. By the time she got to the Irish immigrant district in the West Port, she used her Irish name, Mrs. Doherty. The strategy, if that is what it was, worked perfectly. On entering a grocery store to ask for charity, she was fortunate enough to meet a fellow countryman, whose name, he said, what a coincidence, was Doherty as well. He was a shoemaker who had been in Edinburgh some years, and he invited her back to his room in a tenement not far away. She might stay for a fortnight, he told her, which would give her time to locate her son. At any event, she should stay the night to celebrate Halloween. They returned to his room, where his wife, Nellie, made Maggie Doherty breakfast and helped her do some washing. The man's name was not, in fact, Doherty, but rather William Burke, and though he was indeed from Ireland, he was not related to his new guest. Nellie's legal name was Helen MacDougall, for she and Burke were not formally married, but they had lived for 10 years as man and wife, and she was known to friends and relations as Mrs. Burke. Their house, as even one-room flats were called, was in a tenement near the tanneries on the north side of Wester Portsborough, in an unnamed alley between Weaver's and Grinley's closes. When anyone entered from the main street, there was first one step down, explained a neighbor, Anne Conway, and then a passage, with her own room being the first door that meets you going in. Across the passageway from Anne Conway and her husband, on the left side, was a one-room lodging house run by another neighbor, Janet Law. Burke and MacDougall lived farther along the passage on the right-hand side. A door there from the main passage led down another corridor, between 10 and 15 feet long, which turned to the right and led to a second doorway. Commentators later noted that
sample complete. Ready to continue?